Our next speaker is Naomi Fox from the University of Utah, and her talk is Reconciling Academic and Pedagogical Objectives, a Case Study of Mocho.
Hello. I'm a PhD student at the University of Utah. I am studying language documentation. I do field work. And actually, this entire presentation is going to be not about field work. Actually, it is. But it's going to be about, I'm very convinced that we need to be thinking about pedagogy when we are out in the field doing field work, and sort of my experiences in this area. So here's an overview of the talk. First, I'm going to talk about research ethics. I'm going to talk about description and pedagogy, and sort of give a basic, what the basic foundation of description is, and then what the basic sort of founding principles of pedagogical work are when you come to language materials design, and then incorporating pedagogy into description. And then I will talk about some pedagogical uses for documentary materials and give you some examples from the Mocho project. And I'm grateful for support for field research from the people that are there on this slide. Research ethics. I view it as an ethical mandate of the field researcher to give back to the community in kind. So this is a reciprocal collaborative relationship. And Yamada and Penfield have talked about it in one way or another. England has talked about the obligation of linguistic research, including various things, including training speakers in linguistics and providing documentation which is usable by the language community. And I think nobody would argue that the context of language endangerment sort of changes what a field researcher is expected to do, because there's this time pressure and there's this idea that perhaps you may be one of the last people working on the language. So you have to take that context into account in your what you view as your responsibilities as a researcher. That's just the framework we're going to start from. And then in the question time, you can argue with me about that if you wish. And one of the things that as reciprocity is sort of the idea that I'm talking about here, but why should we worry about the communities we're working with? We go in, we pay them to work with us, we do documentation, it's like a job. So why should we even consider that? And there's a lot of reasons. Endangered language communities increasingly want language learning materials and support for revitalization efforts. And they can't do these on their own. They may not have linguistic training. So these are invaluable to them. This is something I've experienced personally down in Chiapas. Researchers who've engaged in drive-by linguistics have harmed the local view of all future researchers. So I've had to deal with a lot of attitudes that come from other people's research, not my own. Sort of the hangover effect. And that is something to think about. Also, most endangered language communities have a primary concern of teaching the language to their children. So this sort of brings into the idea just creating documentation isn't enough for these communities. They really need things that will help them to do pedagogical activities. So again, I have the reciprocity buzzword, which I like, so you might hear it a couple of times. And here, we talked about this already, because I used the wrong arrow. So documentation and description. I'm shifting sort of gears here a little bit, because I'm assuming that I've convinced you that as an ethical researcher, you are out there and you're going to do something to give back to the community. You may not know what yet, but you're convinced that that is sort of a baseline of research. 20 years ago, that was not a baseline of research. That was not something that was expected to give them copies of your work, to give them copies of recordings. But I think now it is, or it should be. So from the framework of documentation and description, most of the researchers, linguistic researchers who are out there doing their work are doing it from the framework of language documentation. They are doing documentation for a particular purpose, usually to create descriptive materials. They're going to write a grammar. They're going to make a text corpus. They're going to make a dictionary. Or they want to know about a movement in some language somewhere. Descriptive materials provide the basis for almost all pedagogical materials. So people who are creating materials actually go to the grammars and the dictionaries to create the lessons and the books. They don't necessarily go to the community members and sit down with them and create them from scratch. So the quality of documentation determines the potential quality of the final descriptive, pedagogical, and theoretical materials. So if you don't document a language completely, and then you're trying to create learning materials for that language, or you're trying to analyze some theoretical precept, you're not going to be able to do a complete job. So the idea of a complete description or documentation is important here. Okay. The pedagogical viewpoint is, pedagogical approaches are valued by the speaking community, and by many members of the community, they really are the only relevant things. Many community members can't relate to an academic grammar. Dictionaries, they can. They're very widely used, but you know, some of our other things, they kind of don't understand them. But if they have a book that says how you say something or how you do something or how you learn something, they can relate to that. But if I sit down and I write a pedagogical grammar, I don't get my PhD. Okay, they are not necessarily useful in the official career tracks of academics, which you know, can be a little bit of an issue, because if I'm under time pressure to get a dissertation done or to qualify for tenure, that pressure will cause me to focus on things that are important to me. So pedagogical materials are left by the wayside usually. But working on pedagogy and pedagogical materials furthers collaboration and parity, because community members can readily be involved in the creation of these materials. They can give opinions on how things should be done. They can set the framework. They can sort of, it's a way to put researchers and community members at an equal footing and not at this, you know, hierarchy. So here's a couple of examples of the varying approaches to data. It's sort of the perspective, the descriptive perspective and the pedagogical perspective. The descriptive perspective often focuses on elicitation, either based on questionnaires or from texts. They focus on paradigms, narrative texts. There are many other things that are collected in documentation. And it's descriptive in nature. They want to tell you what's going on in the language and all the possibilities of what's going on. The pedagogical approach focuses on getting templatic structures that students can learn sort of how the language functions. It focuses on communicative, being able to communicate in the language, not necessarily knowing every single complex thing about it. There's a focus on repetition, and it's often approached in themed units. And by its nature, pedagogical approaches are prescriptive, because they need to have a definition. This is how this happens. This is how you should say this. They're teaching students how to speak. This is a table of, I've drawn this comparison, and you guys probably can't read it, but it's in your handout, so maybe you can read it there. And it is from my personal experience, and then also a survey of grammars. I surveyed 5 well-known descriptive grammars and 5 pedagogical grammars to see what their structures were like, and if they're really different. You know, if really we could just take one that's descriptive and say, here, let's throw in a couple of practices and it can be pedagogical, right? That's not the case. They are radically different in their perspective and their approach. For example, they're different in even the audience they're designed for. So descriptive grammars are designed by their nature for an audience which has post-high school education, usually post-college educational level. They expect you to have a background in linguistic terminology, and they don't really, you know. Pedagogical grammars don't assume that you know linguistic terminology, and they can't even assume the educational background of their audience. It could be anywhere on the spectrum. Then I'm not going to go through all of these because I don't have time. Again, we see the descriptive versus prescriptive perspective. Another difference between description and pedagogy is descriptive grammars really focus on telling you about every single tiny little complex thing in the language. And how, and that's actually what's cool. It's, they spend lots of time on complexity. And pedagogical grammars build from simplicity to complexity. And they might not get to the fully complex structure that's not necessarily desired. So their entire presentation is different. Also, if you sit down and pick up any descriptive grammar, you have to sort of you know, take a couple of aspirin and have a cup of coffee to read it, because it's all packed, jam-packed tight, and there's no white space, and there's lots of information. And pedagogical grammars are successful if they appeal to the readers. So they have white space. They're laid out nicely. The people are worried about artwork and how things look, much less so than descriptive writers. Another thing that was apparent is, I'm not going to talk about that now. I don't think I have time. Descriptive grammars are also presented and organized around language structures. So there would be nouns, and then they talk all about the nouns, and they'd be verbs, and they talk about transitive verbs, intransitive verbs. And then pedagogical materials, sometimes they would have that organization, but usually most pedagogical grammars do not have a strict organization. Usually they incorporate some sort of thematic organization. So we're going to talk about colors today, and then they might introduce the transitive verb paradigm as well. So they kind of either merged the two or completely went to a thematic approach. So they're very different in their approaches and their audience. Here's an example of a descriptive grammar. And if you were looking at this from the perspective of, oh, well, you know, all the stuff I write could just be used by the community, okay? The first example in 1.3b shows that an oral vowel is raised before a tautosyllabic n, and the latter two examples might indicate that the raising rule is also triggered by a heterosyllabic n. Yeah, so we're all still with me, right? All of us who want to learn, what is this? All of us who want to learn dene su lene, which I can't pronounce correctly. You know, we've all got it. You know, even as linguists, we have to sort of think, what do those terms mean sometimes? So materials don't necessarily cross over directly just because someone's interested in the language. You've really got to think about the structure of the materials and what you're doing if you want to create good and useful materials for the community. Now, do you? Of course you do, because we talked about research ethics earlier, and you're all ready to contribute in kind. Okay, so here's another example of a pedagogical grammar, which, you know, maybe, let's compare the two. The glottalized consonants, and there's a list of consonants, are made by setting the mouth for the consonant and the releasing with the glottis closed. The sounds are made with mouth air rather than lung air, and then it gives you some to practice with, okay? It's a little more accessible. I mean, it's still challenging, and it still would be difficult to learn Navajo without hearing a native speaker. I don't know that that would be possible, but you have some idea of what's going on in the language, even if you don't have linguistic training, okay? Here's an example of an exercise grammar. So they don't sit out and set out grammar lessons. They more go by exercises. And again, it doesn't look like your general 900-page descriptive grammar of a language. Okay, so we know that pedagogy and description are different. We know that we feel, oh, I really need to give back to the community. I really, really do, because that's my ethical sort of foundation. But do I get anything out of it? Other than, you know, appreciation or something. Well, I'm going to actually argue that you do. You actually get some academic benefit of incorporating pedagogy into your descriptive approach or your documentary approach, even though most of the ivory tower does not recognize pedagogical materials as publications towards tenure and promotion and, you know, all those important things. So here are four things that I have noticed are important contributions to your compilation of a full documentary record of the language. First of all, if you're creating pedagogical materials or materials that can be used to create pedagogy, and there's a little bit of a difference there, is gives you a timely practical purpose for the data. So you don't have to wait for years while you're writing your dissertation and then getting it reviewed and then publishing it as a grammar and then getting all the reviews back and they say, well, you need. You can use it right now. You don't have to wait until you submit it to a journal to get it out there. So it's actually right there, and it's practical, and it's kind of rewarding because people actually appreciate it. It's not just your five committee members who've read it, and that's the end of the world, you know? It gives you diversity in data collection. So if you sit down and look at the structures you need to collect for certain pedagogical materials, you will find that they're actually very different than the structures that we traditionally collect in documentation. in documentation, when I'm sitting down and deciding what I need to document to get a full description of Mocho, I might say, well, I need to know about this, this, and this, this. But I might not necessarily think of other things unless they're brought up, and we'll talk about what those are. It expands the range of data collected, and it serves as a system of checks and balances for descriptive efforts. So those last two we're going to talk about expands data collection. These are some areas that I've actually noticed are under-collected in general documentation. They're not necessarily on questionnaires. Some people still collect them, but they're not a focus. And some that are really important are greetings and politeness, both politeness activities and acts and expectations, and also ways to just words to use when you're being polite. These are a couple of gaps that we had when we were working on Mocho and trying to do some different things. And I didn't know what the greeting interchange was because I hadn't thought to collect that. It might have occurred to me at some point, but there's no methodology that says all of these, that helps you to cover all of these things. You may, if you are working on a dictionary, cover more of these. It also verifies and gives a new perspective on data. So you get descriptions from nonverbal stimuli, which has been really great. And a lot of people who are doing documentation do this anyway. But you have to do this for certain lessons, right? Because certain lessons and lesson plans incorporate activities where the students have to, like, one of them has a page and the other one has a copy of it with some things missing, and they have to describe to each other. That's how they do language use. And to, for them to be able to describe, they have to have that modeled. For that to be modeled, there has to be some native speaker who's done it at some point so that they can be taught that. And you find actually a great deal out about the language from these sorts of collections that you may not have sat down with a speaker with a picture of a house with things, and then later with things missing, and compared those two. And you also get insight into speaker intuitions of what they think is important, because they will emphasize certain things to you as you're going through. I'm going to give an example of a way that working on pedagogy actually improved my collection of Mocho data. So I was working with this group of people, and we had decided we were going to do some booklets, and they had given me a list of things to collect so that they could fill in the booklets. And so we were working kind of on Mocho person. Here's the Mocho person marking. This is also in your... Did I give out the handouts? Oh, they're right there. No wonder you can't follow along. Okay, sorry about that. So they're also in the handout that will come around by the time the talk's over. But so Mocho person marking, we were trying to get some possessives of families. We were trying to say my kids and our kids because we were doing a family book. And I couldn't get, well, let's look at Mocho person marking in general, and then we'll talk about how I found out something that may not be the case. So in example set one, we've got some well-behaved data that shows the O prefix is usually dual. The E or the G prefix is usually a third person plural, depending on consonant or vowel stem. And then there's an OO prefix, which in number six, that's not an OO prefix. That first O is part of the stem. And that OO prefix is first person plural exclusive. And so here's the, does everyone have them now? So I don't have to keep going back. So you've got an exclusive-inclusive distinction. This is the traditional analysis of all the zillions of people who worked in Mocho. Actually, there's only a couple. But both of them have sort of followed this analysis. I got this from Laura Martin, but she's following Terry Kaufman's analysis here. So we've got a first-person inclusive and exclusive, and those are defined between O and A. And then here, this was actually a dual form, number one, Lahano, but it could be a plural form. It's really difficult to tell because the word final vowels, you can't really tell if they're long or short. So these are all following that paradigm. They're very well behaved. And then we've got some here. We've got a dual form that has no suffix, so it should not exist. That's not allowed, is it? But my consultant said it, and he's a very fluent speaker of the language. And then we've got a third person plural suffix on number 10. But it's not a third-person plural form. It was actually a first-person plural form. And he was saying, the bones of all of us. And when I asked him, well, who is, you know, we were talking about bones. I don't know how we were talking about bones, but we were talking about them. And I said, well, whose bones are they? And he said, well, you and me and a bunch of other people. I was like, oh, okay. So that must be the inclusive. Well, that's fine, because that follows the paradigm. Okay. But then I got onto example set three. And I got onto this example because I was trying to get him to tell me how to say our children. And it was just him and his wife. And he had major difficulty saying that. And he wouldn't say it. I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to bully you into saying it. But I tried a bunch of sneaky ways to find out how you'd say my wife and I's kids. Okay. And then, like, an hour into the session, we were talking about something else. And he volunteered a form that was our kids. We were talking about something else. And I was like, how come you couldn't say that an hour ago? But really what it happened was he had been thinking about it. And we've got some dual forms showing up without the dual suffix. Then we've got some dual forms showing up like in 11 and 12 with the dual suffix. So we too have four children, or our children. But then in number 13, he was talking, we were both still talking about this our concept. I said, well, what if it was our garden? Like the just, because we had him say my wife's garden and then my garden. And then our garden with the whole family's garden. And he still used this dual suffix, which could also be the first person inclusive because of that weird vowel length thing you can't hear. Okay. But it wouldn't have been inclusive because, or exclusive, well, I guess it would have been exclusive. But then if you look at number 14, 15, and 16, these are all we forms, which should be the first person plural, according to that paradigm, should be the first person plural exclusive. Okay, or inclusive, I'm sorry. Should have been the first person plural inclusive. But all of these were given, both of these sets of forms, 11 through 16, were all given without reference to the second person, without reference to me at all. I was not involved in any of these activities, any of these we's or ours or whatever. What the situation really was, and when he finally sat down to explain it to me with these eat verbs, he said, no, no, if there's just a couple of us, we say this. And he used the O form. If there's a bunch of us, we say this, and use the A form. And then he said, you know, like if we're going up to harvest corn and just me and my sons are going, we'd say, and he used the O form. And then he said, but if the whole pueblo is going up to harvest corn, we'd use this form, and he said the A form. And I wasn't involved in any of these, and I'm the one he's talking to. So there really isn't this, the inclusive-exclusive distinction is not sufficient to describe how person is acting in Mocho. You really need to sort of look at it from a different perspective and say, I think there's a case made that it's not inclusive-exclusive. Maybe it's evolved from that to a we-few-we-many distinction. And so as going through texts, I haven't actually found anything to contradict that. So I'm feeling pretty good about it. I may have found it doing other things, but I found it while I was working specifically on a pedagogical assignment. And so I may have found it at some point, but this really sped along my descriptive efforts and gave me a new understanding. So what if I don't have time, which is kind of what I'm dealing with right now. What if I don't have time to do all this stuff? I want to do it. I see that it's useful. But, you know, how can I give back when I don't have time to do it? Well, here are some examples of materials that could be useful for pedagogy. You can sort of double your workload. So you're collecting these things anyway. Just make them available to the community. Multimedia video recordings, audio recordings, legacy recordings. I give my consultants a copy of every recording that we make right after we make it. And that really makes them happy. Also, annotated text, even if you just give them copies of your annotations, it can be useful. And word lists. I've created a couple of word lists, which are not that time consuming, which have helped along. You can also use legacy materials in creating these pedagogical materials. So you can sort of back up on things. So and here's some ways you can do that. And that's in your handout. Yeah. And so here are the legacy materials we had in Mocho. And we are incorporating these materials into some of the products. The products of the Mocho project, which I started working on, was working on digitization of legacy data. Okay. Before I went to the field, I was just working on taking all the stuff that's been collected and making it digital, modern, and able to be used in descriptive materials. And so this is the things we were going, the tenets of the project. We have some byproducts because of both those legacy materials and my work, the communities are getting these sort of extra free stuff that is not covered in any of the grants. One of them is themed language learning booklets, and my group is going to talk about that a little bit later in the conference. And another is audio and video recordings in Mocho with Spanish free translations in all of these areas. And we've been able to redistribute legacy recordings as well. We also have transcriptions of text in Mocho with Spanish free translations that the community is getting. Okay. So I want to come to the point that documentation kind of leads you to collaboration. Because it, as one person, I can't do all the things that I see as a need in the community. I can't do a good theoretical analysis of the language and also a good cultural analysis and make sure I feel all the ethnobotany stuff and I know all the pedagogical principles that people need and I create all these booklets. I can't do that. I can't do it all well. Nobody can do it well. Maybe someone can. I don't want to say that. But very few people can fill all those roles well. And if you move to a collaborative approach, you get expertise coming in from all these areas. So you have collaboration with native speakers, applied linguists, trained educators, cross disciplines. That will certainly strengthen your documentation as well as being beneficial to the community. Okay, here's some example materials, which you won't have time to look at. But I'll show you. I've got them here, so if you want to catch me sometime, you can look at them and my references.
Questions?
Some comment. I'm very glad that you talked about collaboration because I'm sure throughout this conference we're going to hear about giving back and how language should help people develop pedagogical materials. And I would guess that probably most of us don't know how to do that unless we have some kind of training in teaching of languages, which most of us don't. So it's very essential, I think, to involve the people who know. Otherwise, you can screw them up.
I agree. And I found that that has been very beneficial is my collaboration with people who actually know about how people learn language and teaching. It has actually strengthened a lot of things, including my understanding of those areas just by, you know, fallout.
I wonder whether we should start thinking of having courses in our programs for graduate students that teach how to write pedagogical materials.
That would be nice.
I remember as a phonologist starting to take phonetics in the mid-80s. Now everybody who's in philology does phonetics, but maybe those of us who are doing language documentation need to start thinking about pedagogy as well.
Yeah, how many people speak Mocho?
There are, a generous estimate is fewer than 30. And they're all over the age of 70. Helen?
I just happened to know that you used to be a teacher in the schools, right?
Yes. I did, but I did not have formal teacher training.
Oh,
I
you
kind
didn't?
Of learned
I was
it on the ground.
I just wanted to ask you how much your formal teacher training had helped in this.
Well, it helped because I didn't run away screaming every time they said things like communicative language teaching and context and what are some of the schema building. You know, it didn't scare me off. But I really didn't have the foundation to do it well, I think.
But who said that?
Oh, my group that was helping me make those pedagogical materials.
Okay.
Of people who actually know about teaching.
We're presenting at 3:40 in this room, so and it's building on this presentation. So if you're interested in designing the materials, that's what we're going to talk about.
Short commercial bit.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add. I appreciated your list of what pedagogy offers to I think people who are in academia, and I think there are a few other things as well.
I've actually found that too. I've had consultants who are sort of like, yeah, I'll tell you what you want to know. You know, I'll show up. But then when I said, well, I'd like to make a little booklet for the kids, that's what they were really interested in, kids. And they go, oh, yeah, and we should put this and this and this in it. And then we need to, so we actually had to change our booklet to add stuff, you know, because they were getting excited about it. So I had the same experience.
Different layers, different levels. Pedagogical grammar requires special skills. Description, the same thing. Language documentation, so these are different levels. So I'm still wondering how you can combine everything in one, or do you still keep them separate, but you have them in mind when you're doing language documentation?
I think both could be beneficial. I mean, I found that even once I started talking to these guys, even thinking about pedagogy strengthened my documentation, because I'd sit there and I'd think, well, you know, how would they teach this? And that may or may not have an effect on things, but the way that we did it, I think, worked well for us, and that might not work for everybody. But I don't have the skills to go out and collect the things that would make a good pedagogical grammar. And we didn't have the time to write a pedagogical grammar anyway. So we sat down and made achievable goals that could be replicated in the community with training. And then they made lists of things that they wanted me to tell them how to say in Mocho. And then I would either find them in my data or go collect them the next time I was in the field. So I didn't have to have that pedagogical baseline that it takes years of courses to develop because of the collaboration. We basically said, you guys tell me what language we need and what structure, how structures build on each other. I gave them a little bit of information about the structure of Mocho. And then they told me the things they thought were important. And I think that worked well for us. And if you can get people who will collaborate with you, I think that that model might work okay in a lot of situations. But maybe someone else has a different opinion.
Hi, I missed the first part of your talk, so I don't know if you already talked about it. I was wondering, is this an orally spoken language?
Well,
what script and how do you write?
Linguists write it. but the people don't. None of the speakers can read or write in any language. They can't read and write in Spanish or in Mocho. The younger people who are sort of their grandparents or their fathers speak, they can read and write in Spanish, some of them, but not Mocho. And so we have a little bit of a problem with writing systems and people being able to replicate that. I'm trying to work on that by trying to sort of convince them that, you know, I'll help them through orthography issues. But, you know, that's always a problem, I think. That's one of the reasons we want to incorporate multimedia into our lessons. And we've also made sure that every piece of language we put in our materials, we've got a recording for. So that at some point, even though we don't have funds or time to do it now, at some point we can take this book and make it multimedia because we have those resources.
So what do you mean by multimedia?
Like make a CD or a disc, right? So this community is really interesting. They have no indoor plumbing, no air conditioning. They all have DVD players, every single person. So in this community, multimedia is a great option because...
Thank you.